the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. My name is Joey, that's Len. And before we start, we got to introduce the newest member of the CBP team. Bring him in. This is Moose. He's about 8 weeks old, and he's a mix of Bernese, Mountain Dog, and Poodle. And Len thinks he's going to be 100 pounds. Len, comments?
Good family dog. Going to be big, a lot of hair. Generally very quiet, generally.
Great. Okay, Moose. Good to see you, buddy. Take care out there.
Good to see Moose in the family. We have a new member of the CBP team.
Good to have part of the team here. We're ready for a new pup. So anyway,
when does he take my spot officially? Because then I can actually permanent retirement. That's really what I want to know.
You got to figure out how to do the shorts. Once we teach him how to do the shorts, look.
It's not that hard, man. If I can figure that crap out, anybody can. And once he does, oh my god,
you love
far more views than I do.
You love to see it. Lots to talk about, man, today. Happy Thanksgiving to you guys. Short Ab in the chat reminded me about that. Turkey Day indeed, or at least the day after Turkey Day for many of you.
Gobble, gobble.
Yeah, man. Lots to discuss today, Len. Lots to discuss. We're bringing on a special guest here in about 8 or 9 minutes to talk about the Palestine, Israel-Palestine conflict. Not the politics side, but the impacts. Lots of impacts, obviously, to come from that. But first, Len, maybe we should start with the sponsors. EasyDNS, Mark and team. Actually, Len and I were talking some business on air before the show. We're going to be adding to the website that EasyDNS has built for us. And that includes, I think, a t-shirt store coming, transcripts for each show coming, some English and French articles, and writing that we're going to be doing coming, among other things. And EasyDNS can help you with all of that if you want to host a site. Obviously, it's in the name, DNS hosting. They have VPS servers or VPS virtual private servers if you want to run a Nostr Relay, BTC Pay server, Bitcoin node, you name it. Many different applications for that. And of course, Len, they'll help you bring all your stuff over from whatever crappy service you're using now. You can't beat it. And of course, man, Uncensorable, you know this. Mark wrote the book on this stuff, okay? So we're going to have Mark on the show in November. He doesn't know that yet, but we're going to extend an invite to have him back on here, maybe at my house, which is another thing we're going to start doing fairly soon. So if you're not hosting with EasyDNS, you should start. And how do you do that? You go over, use the code CBP Media, tell Mark we sent you, whatever, 50% off your first round of goods, purchases, hosting, whatever. And we hope you'll try them out. I know a lot of you guys already have, and I hope more of you hop on that train. Led, who's the other sponsor, buddy?
Yeah, we need people to hop on the bull Bitcoin train as well, because if you do, obviously then you could buy some KYC-free sats, which I'll be talking about in a moment, but you could buy on-chain too. You could buy your on-chain, be it Liquid, if that's not on-chain, but you can do that as well. You can also buy Lightning, which is not on-chain, but you can do that as well. So there's a lot of different options you could do with Bull Bitcoin, but not just that. You could pay your bills with Bull Bitcoin. And that is a cool feature, because if you have a lot of Bitcoin in your stack and you want to start spending it, that's one way to do it, is you can start using that to pay your bills. Also, you can buy gift cards and use that in the real world and start spending your Bitcoin indirectly through those gift cards. And you're living the Bitcoin standard just the way Satoshi wanted you to do. But the best thing of all is the KYC freight stuff, where you can actually go ahead, take your dirty fiat to a Canada Post.
Can you believe they're still doing that, Len? Can you believe it? It's almost too good to be true, is it not? Still, after this long, you can go there and get KYC free corn at the post office, dude, of all places.
Using the Canada Post to short the system. Yeah. 6,000 locations plus throughout Canada, and I did a video on that, on how to buy the KYC-free Bitcoin correctly. Check that out. But if you haven't already opened up a Bull Bitcoin account, do so. Use our code below, fund your account, and you know what? You get $21 added to your account, no questions asked.
France is coming on the show in the not-too-distant future as well, so look out for that. Housekeeping, probably now. What do you think? Where do you want to start?
Now let's do we'll do three of the boosts before we move on anywhere else, because we have three noteworthy boosts. MCOT just says cheers and a couple of mugs full of beer, 377 sats. So I like that. Cheers. I don't drink beer, but I'll be happy with that. So next time, write something a little more in there, because I'd love to hear your thoughts about the show and everything. But thanks for the sats, MCOT. Doug and Roop, 625 sats. If only the economy was doing as well as Clown World, my current favorite Ukraine story is that allies are running out of ammunition. When Russia's aspirations stretch a little further, the UK will have nothing to defend itself. Time to develop a taste for vodka and caviar. The UK is not the only one in that position. The United States seems to be also running out of ammunition.
Our listeners, you could be guest writing for this show. We got to get some of these jokes on air here before we do the boost. Save your jokes for us. Our DMs are open.
And Norman Remnant writes in, haven't heard from you in a little while, so good to see you writing in. 696 sats. He's part of the 80 IQ faithful, and he's checking in. Good to see that you're part of the 80 IQ. I'm only 79 IQ, so I got to look up to you. If you're so much more smart than I am. So, yeah, that's basically it for the boosts. And I guess one other thing before for my housekeeping, this week we have an interview. Jesse Berger is coming on Wednesday, 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern. Joey, you're going to be interviewing him. So people out there that want to hear Jesse or you chat about Bitcoin and other related stuff, yeah, check that out. It's going to be a good one.
Jesse, a very vocal Bitcoiner, obviously has a lot to say about the last few years here in Canada. We'll have some stuff to say about Israel-Palestine for sure. We'll try and stay non-political, but all these things impact the Bitcoin market because Bitcoin has become this macro asset, this liquidity magnet that we all talk about, know, and love. So I'm looking forward to that one. Jesse's a guy I've met in person a few times, but I don't think he's actually been on the show. He also wrote the book Magic Internet Money, right? Which is,
we're here.
Fantastic. Great artwork in that book. If you haven't read it, check it out. We'll maybe put the links in Amazon or something, or from Amazon. And I think he's going to have some news for us as well. Maybe share a few details of the stuff that he's doing these days that maybe he hasn't shared publicly. We'll see. So anyway, with that, I see Deer Points in the waiting room here. We'll wait to bring him in. Just another second, make sure he's got his mic and everything.
So just want to state this show, we're going to lead off with the Clown World segment. And then from that, we'll transition to the Bitcoin. So it's going to be reverse based on the guests coming in and the topic we'll be discussing. So we'll just continue on with that segment of Cloud World and go from there. So for people looking for the Bitcoin side of things, it's going to be the back end of this episode.
That's right. Okay, let's bring him in. Deerpoint Macros here. If you don't follow him on Twitter, you should. His Twitter handle, let me pull it up, is Deerpoint Macro, like I just said. And actually, I met Deerpoint in Toronto over the conference weekend. He ditched us. Me and a few of the guys were going to a place called Toy Box, which I found out was maybe not the spot that he wanted to go to. And I'm still unclear on whether or not it's actually true, but he did basically claim to have taken a work call or something. I don't know. So at Deerpoint, you got to unmute yourself. You can join the thing whenever you want and defend yourself and introduce yourself. We're going to talk. If you're going to talk Israel, Palestine, and the impacts here on the market. So Deerpoint, buddy, what's going on?
Nothing much. No, it was a work call. I actually walked back. I forgot that guy's name. I walked back with him. Then I went into the bank and he went on his way. I think he was from Philadelphia. But that place was awful. So I couldn't have been better timing. But just the most typical Euro trash kind of nightclub you could ever imagine in your life. After like a 15-hour day, I could only handle about 30 minutes of that. But thankfully, I was saved. But I guess just a bit about a background on me for people who might not know who I am. I work for like a large institution now. No longer at the place I was before, but I am at a global asset management firm. Currently, also still located in Toronto, but I'm from the States. The Middle East is a region that I know well, kind of a background there. My father is from Azerbaijan, which is a nation that borders Iran. My mother is American, so kind of have a bit of a sweet spot here. But most of my, kind of research has been around economics mostly, but then every now and then just with kind of regional connections and family connections to the region when stuff like this does happen. It's obviously something that I kind of cover on my page as well. So
That's a good intro. And I'm going to make it easy for you. Like I told you in the DMs earlier, there's a few tweets you had that I'm going to share your profile now that I wanted to discuss. Some of
If you can make a bigger, Joey.
Is it big enough now? big enough now?
It's big, but if you could zoom in to make it, because
I can make it bigger. How's that? Okay. So I want to talk about a few things here. First, let's talk about this tweet from 6 hours ago. Higher oil prices weaken the terms of trade for the Europeans pretty significantly. What this means is it decreases the amount of important goods they can purchase per unit of exports. What can explain this? Europe has shown, as nations like Germany that are large exporters and does not produce oil, therefore the external sector for many European nations are highly dependent on the price of oil. I don't. When we talk about oil, we don't often talk about it in terms of the price of unit per exports. I assume this is a result of the invasion, but do you want to talk a bit about this for your reference to your point? This is a chart, like I said, about 6 hours ago, purple, yellow lines. Looks like maybe you put this one together yourself.
Yeah, I did. Sorry, and I just realized I put important instead of imports. So now that I have the blue check mark, I think I can go back and edit that. But yeah, so essentially, yeah, terms of trade is something that's very important. But you know, when you kind of look at Europe, and this will probably kind of lead into the second chart, the one that you touched on. You know, Europe has a large manufacturing base, most of that being, you know, Germany, but as well as you have places like the Netherlands that continue to run trade surpluses as well. When you kind of look at Europe, they do have this very large external sector, but that external sector has essentially it's very tied to the price of oil. Just as a function of the fact that Europe doesn't have its own kind of domestic oil supply or doesn't produce oil itself. And so what then ends up happening is as you start to see, you know, rises in the price of oil, it then starts to affect terms of trade for the Europeans. It can kind of happen through, a mechanism of things, but you know, sometimes this coincides with, you know, economic weakening or weakening of the manufacturing sector as, you know, input prices start to rise. And then this flows through into, you know, a weaker euro, which we actually have seen. And then that kind of, you know, weakens the terms of trades for the Europeans. But oil is kind of a big factor in that, just like I was saying, because they don't produce it themselves. And so as the price of that starts to rise, you know, it increases the cost of production for a lot of these manufacturing industries. And that does kind of put a lot of pressure on the Europeans. And something that's very significant for them as well is the Swiss canal, which is, you know, actually the second tweet. And, you know, if anything kind of starts to happen there on the border of Egypt and Israel, which accounts for about 10% of oil and gas supply that canal lets through. If that something does happen or there's disruptions there, most of that would then further kind of hamper Europe and definitely lead to supply side inflationary pressures through higher input prices, just as effective, you know, supply chain issues if anything does start to dampen the Swiss canal.
That's okay. So the canal is a story that I haven't seen anyone tweet about except you. I want to ask you if you have a view on, you know, sort of what is the percentage of additional pressure? That's probably a terrible way to word it, but I mean, how much additional pressure can we expect Europe to be able to stomach? I mean, they've really taken the bat to the nuts here a little bit over the last year and a half, 2 years or so, because of the war in Russia. And now this, they refuse to drill, explore anything oil related. They've done some coal, but also refused to go to nuclear. Do you have a view on the energy picture in Europe heading into what could be a less friendly winter than last year?
Yeah, I do think that Europe is probably going to continue to see some strains from the energy side, but you know, how quantifiable that I haven't really done, or like I couldn't really answer, but I definitely do think that you're going to continue to see upward pressure for the Europeans from, you know, higher import prices for oil and, you know, kind of where oil has been trading. And if you give me a second, I could look at where the TTF is. But, you know, a lot of those things have, you know, led to a lot of strain for the Europeans. And so I don't really expect much of that to change. But if the Swiss canal did get closed, or if something happened I do think, at least in the short term, the effects could be pretty catastrophic for Europe, just because that's how they get all of their oil, right? You know, the Swiss Canal is a big, big, big player in that. And so if there was any disruptions, I do think that the move in oil and in probably, you know, some other futures, because containers, I think 22% of global containers, almost 30% actually go through the Swiss Canal. So that could also kind of add further pressure in other sectors, and kind of dry bulk, et cetera, for Europe as well. So there's a lot of things that could push, you know, inflationary pressures upward for the Europeans if the Swiss Canal does face any sort of, shutdown or kind of delay or backlog in getting ships through that little canal there.
That's insane. So I want to ask you now, in a related, chart and tweet, this crude moving and only up from here after conflicts in Palestine, Israel moving, historical forward returns are always positive. 2032 bond futures also up. Seems flight to quality, DXY also getting bid. Talk to me a bit about this bond thing. We dabble in bonds here in the Bitcoin space from time to time. Mostly we laugh at bond holders. Mostly we call them bond normies, things of this nature. Always derogatory, always fun. But in this case, you've pointed to a link, I think, between oil prices, bond futures, DXY. Talk to me about this chart a little bit. What am I looking at here? Why is this important?
Yeah, so obviously yesterday, some people were like, okay, well, what's happening in Palestine and Israel isn't all that significant. Given, like, from an oil perspective, given, like, it's not Saudi Arabia, it's not Iran, it's not Kuwait, it's not those big kind of Arab Gulf, producers. But the thing was, I went back and back tested that. Sorry, had to sneeze. I went back and back tested that, and I haven't put that chart out yet, but if you plot on the y-axis the change in oil, and then you plot like a time series on the x-axis, so 100 days before conflict, and then 100 days after an Israeli-Palestine conflict, the forward returns on oil are always positive. Oh, God. And this change of weather in Toronto is killing me. and then last time, which I think was, two Ramadans ago, Ramadan of 21 was really the last kind of, I would say, large-scale conflict when we saw people protesting, et cetera, kind of like what we're seeing, today in Toronto and around the world. The last time that we saw that was Ramadan of 21. And, 100 days out after that conflict happened, oil was up 15%. So, the implications for this, even though people are like, well, Israel and Palestine aren't these, OPEC producing nations in the Gulf, probably won't have much effect. That just hasn't really been shown in data. It actually usually has quite a significant effect. As for bonds, essentially what we saw was that bonds ended up getting, they were getting pushed higher last night. As essentially you had a flight to quality. The long-term bond went completely parabolic. I think it was around like 111 and change. I don't remember the exact yield on that, but it went pretty parabolic yesterday. Granted, the cash markets were closed. It was only the future markets that were opened. So that could just be thin liquidity as well. But we started to see things like that made sense. I'm sure many of you guys remember the 5-year glitch. And the reason that I knew that this wasn't a glitch was you started to see movements in FX pairs. So why that's significant, and I'll end it here, is when you see a large move in a nation's yield, this changes the interest rate differential, which does have kind of an effect on currencies. So, if one nation's interest rate rises, usually that sees more people or more demand for that nation's currency. And this can be due to, kind of a plethora of reasons. That didn't happen on the 5-year yield glitch, but we did start to see, I think the Dixie opened like plus 50 basis points, something around there. And so it started to make sense. Okay, yields are we're seeing this upward pressure on long-term bonds. We're seeing this upward pressure on the dollar. It's people, you know, looking towards a flight to safety. So yeah, that's kind of how all of that intertwines together.
I really appreciate you saying that stuff about the glitch, something we've talked about a little bit on the show in the past. I know that was a big story. I want to ask you about one non-Israel-Palestine thing, and then I'll ask you for your views on Bitcoin, because this is something we talk about a lot in Bitcoin, as I'm sure you know. Canadian Fiscal Authority undoing all the tightening for the Bank of Canada. Outlays are up almost 10% year over year. Huge stimulus to the economy. You have first interest payments. This boosts aggregate demand. Next retirees saw decent transfers as Canadian populations age. Revenues are falling from the decreased individual income taxes. Talk to me about this. We mentioned this on the show, but you're articulating in a way that, you know, probably a pro could do and we cannot, how the government is basically doing everything they can to give back the progress Bank Canada's made. What am I looking at here? I think, by the way, this is another Deer Point original chart, right?
Yeah, it is. I'm originally from the U.S. I'm from South Carolina. So for anybody who watches college football, the purple and orange is Clemson Tigers. You know, we beat Wake Forest this week. So, you know, things are going good. We're 4-2. We've had pretty bad previous last two seasons. But for anybody who's like, why is this color combination? Usually guys from the South, they pick it up pretty fast. They're like, this guy's a Clemson fan. And just a quick anecdote. I have another guy who follows me, who's a Gamecocks fan, who's like Clemson's rival for people who might be in Canada and not understand.
Well, that's the actual South Carolina team, is it not?
Well, it depends on where you are. If you're usually in the lower part of the state, a lot of people are USC fans. The upper part of the state is usually Clemson fans, just because that's where Clemson is. It's in the foothills, like near the Blue Ridge Mountains, where Columbia's kind of down closer to the coast. But there's one guy who takes all of my charts and then just replicates them as burgundy and black. he'll just copy my chart and then it's like, I guess draw it, but it's always fun. But, with that being said, what are we looking at here? So, for people who don't know what fiscal outlays are, I'll try to pretty much simplify it. That's like essentially direct cash from the federal government to the private sector. And it can be like other things like the government, you know, paying interest on debt, et cetera, but it's always actual cash transfer. And so what we have started to see is obviously with interest rates, interest payments are going up. And this is going to depend on your theory of economics. If you're a monetarist, what you would say is that paying interest on government debt is actually a stimulus of aggregate demand. Again, I won't like delve into the different economic theories on that, but anyways, what we are seeing is that Canada's population is extremely old. I think a lot of Canadians know that. And so what's now happening is you're seeing transfers, whether it be through old age, you're also just seeing an increase in government transfer payments to people who might be on, you know, unemployment, et cetera. And this boost has been massive. And so usually what happens is when you're starting to see an increase in outlays, this usually corresponds with a, you know, it technically shouldn't, but it usually coincides with a fall in revenues because the government is running a deficit. Either they're issuing debt to essentially, you know, pay out these outlays. And then as a function of that, the deficit grows and revenues aren't enough to essentially cover the deficit. But, you know, that's pretty much what we're seeing now is that Canada is trying to keep the private sector afloat. And they are they're doing that through these kind of direct government stimuluses to the private sector.
That's good commentary there. There's no doubt about that. And I'm sure we'll keep it up at some point. Now, we got to move on with our show here. But before we do, give me 30 seconds. You don't like Bitcoin. Why the fuck not?
Because I'm a monetarist. I guess I could sum it up, you know, quicker than that. But yeah, I mean, I'm a monetary guy, right? So, I mean, like, I don't have a problem with gold, those kinds of things, but I've never really understood the Bitcoin use case. So I've always been in the, and kind of the similar to Britt Johnson, the dollar camp.
Well, I have a no pointer of the week, at least. Yeah. Dear Point,
no,
thank you for...
We can't give it to Dear Point. Dear Point, next time I see you, we'll meet up at Toy Box. I'll bring you a open dime with a couple sats on it, and we'll get you started on your journey, buddy. Anything you want to share, Pump, before you go?
No, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. And then obviously, you know, the best place to follow me is pretty much Twitter. I mean, and anybody who's in Toronto, I'm usually pretty open to meeting up. I hope you guys have a good Thanksgiving and, you know, fake Thanksgiving, Canadians. But I hope you guys have a good Thanksgiving. And thanks so much for having me on.
You got it, brother. Thanks very much. Dear Point Macro, first time guest on CPP. He's a good dude, man. I got to say, I know I'm giving him a hard time about the summer there, but he was a good dude to hang out with. I enjoyed having a few pints with him. And thanks to Green Candle for hooking us up. He introduced me, and I've kind of spoken to the guy a few times since. So with that said, Len, shall we continue with our usual content here? What do we got next?
Yeah, I want to pipe in on the Middle East stuff because I want to just point out a few things. So because oil definitely is a big thing. Saudi Arabia mentioned they're going to be ending all negotiations on normalization with Israel. This is huge because obviously Saudi Arabia has been a strategic ally of the United States, and the United States will presumably still back Israel, right? Like, we can look at modern history here. And if you consider 70s to be modern history, like we had in 73 October, there was the Yom Kippur War. And at that time, there was an oil embargo that was led by OPEC at that time. I forget the name it was, but that version of OPEC was led by Saudi Arabia. And that oil embargo basically restricted the flow of oil to a bunch of countries that were helping or assisting Israel at that time, and United States, Canada, UK, and a few others were there, right? Like, so this thing could happen again. History can't easily repeat itself again. Saudi Arabia is getting closer and closer to China and Russia, and less to United States. And what resulted from that oil crisis, for people that are not aware, this is even before my time too, so that shows you how long ago it was. But the price of oil went up 3x. It went from $3 a barrel at that time to a little bit over $11, almost $12 in change.
Well, you heard what he said, like 15% in 100 days on these, historically, the Israel-Palestine conflict. Like, that's a lot, man.
But now we're talking 300%.
Yeah.
That was at that time. There's a huge difference between the two, because then we also had, people over here, there was long lines at gas stations. Muscle cars, they stopped selling them because obviously they couldn't put the fuel into them. The world changed. For the better, for the worse, whatever, but it changed quite a bit as a result of all this. But there's going to be potentially history repeating itself. And if you have to look back, if it does repeat itself, does the U.S. and its allies, like Canada, do we have the capacity right now to meet the demand for all of our friends out there?
No.
The answer I'm going to say is probably no. We're probably going to have to start buying from Venezuela or Russia, or we're going to have to then suffer the consequences of this. You know, people out there, they're angry with oil. They're saying oil is causing this and that for the climate, and it stopped oil and all this shit. Okay, you know what? Once you have this change and there's no more oil coming in here, remember, there's going to be no more food that's going to be readily available on the grocery shelves.
Right.
Your order for skinny jeans, it's not going to come in a couple of days from Amazon. It's going to take weeks, if not months. Charging your phone won't happen for pennies. It's going to happen for fucking dollars. And cooling your home in the summer and heating your home in the winter, it's not going to happen. Your home is going to be cold in the winter, hot in the summer, because you can't afford to fucking use AC or heat it. But back to the oil thing, I just wanted to stress, this is something that's very important here. I'm not saying what's going on there is the United States should or shouldn't back. I'm just looking at history, and history can't repeat itself. Yellen, of all people, Janet freaking Yellen, said she's going to be enforcing the price cap on Russian oil. How the fuck can you do this? You can't even keep your own border secure, and you're going to try to impose a price cap on a global commodity that's being sold at the other side of the world? Give me a fucking break. That's impossible.
Man.
It truly is. And
I know.
The SPR, that's another thing I just want to bring up. Roughly right now, the SPR is sitting at one half the volume it was just a few years ago. Still, there's still a lot of oil in there, but it's still a lot of oil that's now no longer there. And luckily, if you look at the U.S., they are right now a net exporter of oil. Still to this day, even after stopping with all the permits for drilling of oil and shit, they're still a net exporter of oil. but they could meet, if they want to, meet all their domestic needs and also refill the SPR. But this is going to come at a huge cost for the people who would have bought the oil that they sold off. The SPR, this is going to make it, like, because it's being so low, it would make any engagement with the U.S., any long-term, lengthy engagement, drawn-out one, very difficult for the U.S. to maintain, because they do not have the oil to supply the war machine, which is thirsty for oil. And now you have, you're supplying shit to Ukraine, you're supplying shit, presumably, I think, I'm going to say this is probably going to happen, to Israel. It's going to end up, they're not going to have enough to go around. And I just have to end this at this point. All this stuff, this war, that war, all this shit, it's all fucking fiat driven, right? Like, U.S. sending aid to Iran and allegedly that being used to help fund Hamas, fucking fiat driven, right? There's no way. Another one, U.S. sending resources to Ukraine, who allegedly sold them to Hamas. I don't know if it's true. This is what they're saying. Again, that's another fiat driven bullshit. The Israeli Iron Dome, another fiat driven crap. Like, all this loss of life and the changes which come along as a result of it, it's all fiat driven. Everything. I'm tired of this shit. I'm tired of it. And people continue to die needlessly just because it's fucking fiat driven. It really isn't worth it. We got to end this stuff. Once we end this stuff and we use a hard money thing, hard money, something like Bitcoin, fuck, even gold to a degree, it is very much manipulated, but it's still hard money as long as it's done right. This shit ends. And we live in a world that is less, it's more safe and it's more pure, in my opinion.
It doesn't take much to see that this is all driven by fiscal promiscuity, right? Like you mentioned there, everything is just printed money. The wars are all printed money. They're all inflationary by nature. And so the other question I have, like, and maybe I'll talk about this with, I don't know, with Deer Point on Twitter or something. I should ask them. Like, the inflationary pressure that comes from war here, you know, presumably the U.S. is, like you mentioned, going to start sending more arms overseas. How inflationary is that going to be? What are we talking about here? There's going to be money floating around. I see that some countries are also, Israel, I think, is selling U.S. treasuries to defend its currency instead of moving into U.S. treasuries as a flight to safety, which you may have expected to see. It's all very strange. And, like, there is some element here of history repeating itself, like you mentioned. But I'm curious, you know, this has not really happened in an environment where the debts of governments have been so, you know, enormous that even the normie on the street is like, don't worry, they'll just print the money. This is the first time I think that's really happened in a first world, axis of powers, or for a first world axis of powers. And I'm curious as to what the outcome is going to be here. I think a lot of people are looking at this and going, how can the U.S. extend out to another war? You know, they're in Ukraine. They're, you know, probably still other places in the Middle East. They're talking about Taiwan, defending Taiwan or not defending Taiwan. You mentioned the southern border, which is small potatoes, of course, but they still can't figure it out, or at least don't want to figure it out. And now this, it's very difficult to imagine how they're going to, you know, on the sort of broad end, how they're going to figure out the monetary implications and the fiscal implications and the implications for the currency. But on the sort of on like the tip of the spear, how does any American citizen, you know, even worse, like maybe any citizen in the world, and this is not a political statement about the nature of the war, but rather, you know, something that each first world government should have to reckon with before they send money overseas. How does the average citizen believe still at this point that they are anywhere near the top of the priority list for the government they elected? They're not. I don't think any first world country can really say that at this point. Between the energy missteps, wars overseas, open borders, inflation, monetary promiscuity, fiscal promiscuity, like I said earlier, you know, it's clear, right? And so I just wonder for people, and to your point, like I said, he doesn't like Bitcoin. He mentioned why. I guess the thing I would ask is, like, why do you want to be in a system that's clearly controlled by the same government who thinks you're nothing but a tax receipt at this point? Why not get into Bitcoin? Bitcoin is this like little shining beacon of hope, I think, for a lot of people. It was for me when I first started getting into it. And I think for you too. And for a lot of people, it's become a huge part of our lives because it changes the way you think about money and time horizons, things like this. Well, this is where you want to be, man. It's not in the place where you're still relying on these governments who literally will either tax you to death or send you to your death overseas for some war in which you have no part and no commitment. It's not right. And I hope that people think about this stuff, you know, decide where to spend your money, decide what system you want to play in. it's clear to a lot of people that there's a problem here. What's not clear is that there's already a solution available if they're willing to kind of take the jump.
What I'm seeing on Twitter is there seems to be a lot of support from one side or another. So whatever's transpired the past few days, it's raised a lot of people awareness, and now they're supportive of something else. Yeah, because the support that used to be there for Ukraine has
current thing theory, right? What's the current thing?
Well, more so than the current thing, it seems like there's a lot of graphic images out there, and people mm-hmm. look at that and it's like, wow, we got to do something about that. But one thing that I noticed this past weekend with talking to a lot of normies is that I think people are tired of being second, third, fourth, or last on the list of things to be thought of. There's so many things that are wrong, and people cannot, and chiefly being people cannot afford food these days. A lot of people can't. And people are now noticing this, and they're wondering, why do we still have to send money here or money there when it could be spent on money here? And I think finally this is coming to fruition where people are realizing that funding this shit, I don't want to say this shit, funding wars ultimately is, and you mentioned it, is inflationary. And people are coming to grips with this, and they want to stop this kind of stuff. You'll probably still have a few people that want to continue doing it, but there's going to be a lot less people willing to do it. Like, I don't know what else to say. This is, it's pathetic that people are losing their lives. It's pathetic that people are being dragged through the streets, and still, like, there's pathetic people are not even able to fucking find food or rent or pay for rent or have shelter over here. Like, the priorities, man. Priorities. Yeah. Like, you know what? I don't know what to say.
Not to mention, there's never a clean accounting of the money, which is another problem I have. And also, I saw a tweet, and we shouldn't go any further because we're going to get ourselves either into trouble or we're going to fall behind more so than we already have. But the thing is that, like, for all these people who talk about how, you know, virtue signaling is important and we have to downplay our strengths in order to be strong, et cetera, do you think either of these groups of militants, countries, whatever, think that way? Like strength is the only language that matters when the chips are down. It's the only one that matters. And you may not agree with the displays that are being put out there. Certainly I don't. But to argue that these people are concerned with anything but displays of power is a complete miscalculation on your part. And sometimes I would say, as Doomberg likes to say, you know, you're either a sucker for buying into it or a knowing architect of it. But you have to be one or the other at this point, especially because this has become so front and center so quickly. Strength is the only thing that matters. And I would ask people who, you know, really have a lot of faith in first world systems, monetary or otherwise, do you see strength in the countries in which you are living? I would guess that the answer right now is something along the lines of less than I would like. And I think that's a concern as things continue to kind of, you know, separate from the norm here over the last month or two, you know, probably longer than that now, but you get the idea.
You know, when I think of strength, Joey,
Hit me with the fucking segue. What is it?
Yes, European Central Bank, because that's something that comes to mind when I think of strength. And they're going to be doing something. They're going to be willing something into existence, something unthinkable, but they're going to will it into existence. Madame Lagarde was out there just this past week. She's the ECB president. And she was saying that she's confident that they're going to bring inflation down to the 2% goal. And she's saying that the economic reforms underway in Europe is going to help them achieve that goal. And the only way possible that this is within a relatively short time frame, we're talking a year or two to reach 2%, they have to make tough choices. They got to make tough choices that probably will cripple the economy. They have to bring in high taxes. They got to drastically cut down on spending. And they got to make a lot of these choices, these tough choices that are going to encourage financial stability in the short, medium, and long term. Or they could simply just cook the books and hit 2% regardless of what reality is telling us. So I think those are the two ways they could do it. Whichever way they do it, but I think the cooking of the books is probably the real thing that they're going to be achieving here for getting 2%.
I mean, how is it not? I assume we're going to talk about the U.S. Department of Labor Statistics here at some point.
Oh, we'll talk on that.
Why don't you link these two stories, and then we'll talk about what it looks like to cook the books.
Okay, well, the jobs report came in for the U.S., and this is for September. And nobody is believing the numbers here. The U.S. economy claims that they've added 336,000 jobs for the month of September. It's almost twice the amount that was expected. Expectations were around 170,000 jobs to be added. And the way I'm looking at this, Joey, they should really be aiming for the moon. Next time they report on something like this, they should report that they've reached 33.5 trillion jobs. One job for every dollar that they're in debt. Because this way, if they do it, then they could really say, look, we fucking did a good job here. By the way, the debt went up $275 billion this past week. Mm-hmm. In one day this past week. That's a lot of fucking money. But anyways, back to the job report. They say that leisure and hospitality led the way with 96,000 jobs, and followed by government jobs at 73,000. So it's 96,000 for leisure and hospitality, 73,000 for government. And so about half the jobs are either government jobs, Uber drivers, or people working at restaurants. And when I look at this, these are metrics that just scream of success. And I wonder, too, is how many people that are being captured in this stat here, the job report stat, are elderly that are forced to re-enter the workforce because they cannot make ends meet based on their savings, their pension, or whatever else they get that they're using to try to fund their retirement. Or I wonder how many are getting their second job to make ends meet, or even a third job. Well, in fact, I have an answer to the first question. The number of people holding two full-time jobs hit an all-time high of 447,000 jobs. There are people holding two, not one, but two full-time jobs, and they are still struggling to make ends meet. This is not a sign that this is getting better. It's getting worse, and the end is much sooner than people think, and that's a stat that proves it.
I mean, if you look at the jobs report from the States, I want to talk about, like I said, what it looks like to cut the books. Full-time jobs are on the decline. Part-time jobs are on the rise. It's from Zero Hedge. The bottom 40% of households are losing COVID savings. They're down to below pre-COVID level, basically, in every case. Maybe the most important thing, though, that is that the middle 40%, so the bottom 40%, the middle 40%, now lower in real household savings than before COVID. That's bad. If you want to go even further, the top 20% is only about 100 basis points away from... I guess it'd be 1,000 basis points, about 10% away from having their savings at the same level they were before COVID. That's 100% of American households. That's crazy. Now, even better, if you want to talk about how you know the jobs numbers are bullshit, think about this. Tax receipts in the States are down below 2019 levels. So you tell me how, with the strongest job market in recent memory, of course, right before an election, Len, of course it is. Tax receipts are down to levels not seen since before COVID. How can that be possible? How can it be possible? Are people evading their taxes? They just hired 500,000 IRS agents with guns to collect taxes from normies. Those guys are not doing their jobs? Are people all skirting their... Like, what's happening? I'll tell you what's happening.
It's not real numbers. It's not real.
None of the numbers are real.
These fucking bucks.
Again, like, Gelman Amnesia here, guys, okay? And girls. If you see clearly in the data... that something doesn't add up. And like, I'm not a fucking economist, although if I was, maybe I'd see this even less. But I'll tell you that you can't have non-farm payrolls and employment numbers from the Department of Labor Statistics looking fantastic and have tax receipts at a five-year low. How can that be the case? Are people working and paying taxes or are they not? You cannot have it both ways. So I would just ask people, like, are you sure that the other stats are not cooked? Are you sure the inflation's not cooked? Are you sure the price of, you know, whatever is in that basket is not being cooked? Are you sure that numbers about, you know, how many people are employed or like all this stuff, man, it's massaged. All of it's massaged. And I got to be honest with you, Len, the normie class is so brain dead. Did you catch the game last night type beat, which I've taken some shit for in a couple of chats over the last, you know, year or so. But they're so brain dead that you can just cook the books all you want because these people don't know, don't care, and don't have the bandwidth to actually look. All they do is go to the store and go, huh, that's weird. I thought inflation was only 2%. This steak is like $8 more than it was a year ago or whatever. I can't keep up with my wages. If I ask for a raise, I'll get fired. I got to drive Uber Eats. I got to do this. I got to do that. It's only going to get worse because the situation overseas, as we mentioned earlier, as Dearpoint explained to us very well, is destabilizing now in a way that it hasn't destabilized before. And I don't have a lot of faith that a lot of these numbers are not cooked. I don't have a lot of faith in this. I know we're going to talk about the Bank of Canada's recent sort of, you know, outreach and essay writing, you know, whatever they do in their free time, story time papers or whatever. But, you know, it's bad in the States too. Canada is one thing, but the States is outright just making shit up. they're just making it up. Honestly, what else can you say? I'm not sure how else to describe it.
And they revise it after the fact. And then
they revise it downward. That's the best part.
Yeah. And so then it gets closer to the real
data. We got the data. We're going to decide what the rates are based on the data, what the interest rate is, and then we're going to change the fucking data. Can you imagine? This would never, you would never be able to do this in your job. Okay, we're going to do some project work here. We need to make a large investment in a software platform to help us do this kind of work. Well, what kind of work are you going to do? Well, we're going to do this work, that work, A, B, and C. Okay. Okay, well, we need a platform that does A, B, and C. Okay, well, let's go get this platform. Well, it's $2 million for the whole company. Okay, let's do it. Yeah, we'll do it. Okay, and then a month later, you actually only do A and B work, so you didn't need to spend the $2 million. Oh, and the $2 million actually is $3 million once the contract is like, once the contract comes to fruition, you get the deliverables. That's like a, you know, harebrained example, but it's like the same thing. You could never get away with this anywhere else. And the other thing that I don't get is like—
You're describing government construction projects when they redo roads and stuff. That's
you either have the data or you don't. And then just like Powell for him to get up there and be like, oh, we're data driven. What the fuck does data driven even mean if the data is always changing? How many downward revisions? And when I say downward, I don't mean like nominally. I mean sentiment wise revisions have there been on government data specifically related to prices and employment over the last 2 years? Every fucking one. And so you got all these guys on Twitter talking about, oh, well, the data's looking good. It's strong. It's this, it's that. Powell gets up there. We're data-driven. We're looking at stuff. And every central bank is doing the same thing. And they're all making it up. And even worse, the other central banks, you can't even really make it up for the other central banks because the only data that really matters, even for Europe, is the U.S. data. What is the U.S. going to do with their rates? What are they going to do with their treasury yields? So you can't even make up the data. You could, I guess. But it doesn't matter because no one cares what your data is. It is the biggest shell game, Ponzi, crackpot, nonsense, scheme, scam that we have ever seen. And it's just about done. It seems to me that it's just about done. I can't imagine sitting in gold stocks, gold, fuck, I don't know what else, like even fucking land, real estate. Like we'll talk a little bit about real estate, I'm sure today, but like I got to say as a homeowner here, I've never felt less good about the home purchase than I have in the last like 2 weeks.
It really depends how much equity one has in that home.
I don't have a huge loan on my house. I'm lucky, but still, like it's just they're gonna come for something somewhere, and it just seems to me like honesty is not in the cards for the U.S. at this point. It's just not. So let's see what they do. I don't know. At least it's good content for us. Maybe once we're living in shanty towns, as long as there's a plug somewhere, we can do the show in person. We can live in the same shanty town, maybe, and we can do like 3 shows a week. The content will be never ending. It'll just keep coming.
It's going to be all in person. We won't have enough power to computers and everything. Yeah, one plug will be enough. So we have to do it during the daytime and hope it's a sunny day. And that's the only way we could do a show. If not, it's going to be everything in person. I mean, you talked about the treasuries, and they got absolutely obliterated last week. They're getting obliterated these days. I don't want to talk about this at all. And if you want to go and talk about it, the floor is yours.
You're talking about TRY, right? The
The 30 years, the 10 years, the 5, everything.
It's inversely correlated to the actual real yields like of current treasuries, I'm pretty sure, if I have that right. So as those things drop.
The 30 years hit 5%, by the way. That's crazy.
30-year mortgages in the States now, by the way, are like 8%. So yes. if you want to buy a house now, you want to lock in for 30, what are you going to do? I don't know. 30 years is a long time.
You know what? Only people that have a 3% mortgage are the people that bought 5 years go or earlier than that.
Yeah.
Everybody else that's bought in the past four years, I'm even wrong, past year and a half, 2 years, they're not in a good position. They're a much, much higher mortgage rate. And it's sad, but whatever. That's fiat driven. It's all fiat driven.
All fiat driven.
Let's talk about something else that's fiat driven. It's just these fucking banks. So we have a couple of banks that are in trouble. Number one, we have Metro Bank, and that's a UK bank. And they've been taking a kick to the teeth on the market as shares have been dropping very, very fast. I'm not sure if you look at their share price, but it's like dropping like the Patrick Mahomes passes this year. The bank stocks were trading in February for a little over $150 per share. And even though it's recovered today, it's trading around $50. So from February, $150 to $50 right now, the company was in absolute dire straits. And even with this massive drop, the company even rallied 20% today. 20% because it was able to secure what they claim badly needed fresh capital. When a bank needs fresh capital so fucking bad just to keep doing business. You know they're on their last legs. A lot of these small banks are absolutely fucked. They secured a 325 million pound capital raise and also a 600 million pound in debt refinancing that is far exceeding the capital that they raised. So they're still in massive debt here. Metro Bank said the raise will provide the opportunity to shift towards specialist mortgages and commercial lending. They're going to go balls deep in real estate. Look at this. Is it fucking seriously? Here's another one that's going to really go tits up. Blue Ridge's bank shares. The ticker is BRVS. Today it went down another 10%. Down 50% in the last month, 70% in the last year. It's another shitcoiner chart. There's going to be a lot of these smaller banks. They just don't have the capital that they could shield themselves from these times, because they're going to have to pay out a lot more to customers that have money and savings. There's going to be a lot of customers that are going to be declaring bankruptcy. They're going to be holding the bag in the end when they're not able to pay the mortgages and they're not able to pay for everything. Eventually, they're just going to go insolvent, which they probably already are right now. But we're going to see a lot more that just, you can see their stock prices go down because nobody has the faith in these banks from actually doing business month to month, year to year, because there's going to be some consolidation in this space. I don't think we're going to have as many banks as we have right now. There's going to probably be a lot more that are going to be gobbled up by the bigger banks. And this is being done for the past few decades. And this trend is going to continue down this path. But I suspect, I'm going to put it behind me in the wall, is the last time we're going to have, when we have another bank failure. And I said last time I had put like 3 days, 4 days, 5 days from the last bank failure, we're going to have this coming again. Another bank is going to collapse in the next little while. Even in Canada, it might happen. Look at the bank stocks for these bank companies, and they're not doing well. This is reflection of their business. They're not in a good position. Who's going to back them in the end? The central bank. Who's that? Us.
Not doing well. Yeah, not doing well is an understatement. I'm glad you mentioned the Canadian banks. Harris Kupperman, who I would love to have on this show, Cuppy, I hear him on Market Huddle all the time. I think he's a fantastic guest, great market analyst, and probably a decent guy too. Had his Adventures in Capitalism letter come out today, which I'm a subscriber to. I don't pay for it, but I do get like the baseline of the the gist of the article, the gist of the recommendation, the gist of the view. And Len, I'm going to pull it up on the screen here. Do you know what this is?
No.
First of all, does that look like an investable chart to you?
No. It's flat at best. RBC?
It looks like it's rolling over. That's the Canadian Bank Index. That's the big four, I think. Big four, big five. He's pointing out, and I think a lot of Americans are realizing this, because obviously the dividend masters on YouTube have been saying to invest in nothing but banks and railroads for the last 20 fucking years.
Go to 10 or 20 years. I'm curious to see what the chart looks like longer, because we're at levels around 2007, 2008, from what I recall.
So if you were out of the stock, like these things are pretty shit anyways, but if you were in, you know what I mean? Like if you were in one of these, what do you want to see, 20?
Yeah, I'm curious. See, look, it's basically,
yeah.
Like, okay, it said this is the wrong one. I was looking at a couple of stocks that were bank stocks in Canada. There are 2007 levels. What is that? It's been flat for 15 years. And you're right. The dividends might carry you for a little while.
The dividends are paid out. Okay, yeah, nominal terms. The dividends are fine. But like in real terms, what are you getting? Are you still getting the same, 17 cents a share or whatever that you were? Probably. If the dividend hasn't gone up by 200% or 300% in the last 15 years, you're behind the curve. And the money you have invested in the bank stock isn't doing anything, so you're behind the curve there too. Like, this is the same math that bond holders should be doing, right? Nominal terms, yeah, you're getting something back. But in real terms, what are you losing? What is the opportunity cost of parking in bonds? Even for a year, it's pretty high. If you're not parked in something like Bitcoin that's been accelerating away from everything else over the last decade, you're losing money. And to see the bank stocks look like this, it's hard to argue, I think, even if you're a normal kind of, Joe or Jane investor, that's a good place to park your money. How does a bank teller, basically a glorified bank teller, sell that stock to you? They do it with a dividend, right? And so I think a lot of people now are realizing, well, hey, the dividend, unless I park, 50 grand in a bank stock, that dividend's really not going to do much for me. Oh, but it'll compound. Compounding doesn't mean the same thing it used to when inflation is 10%, 15% a year. It's just, it doesn't matter. None of it matters. The currency is failing, guys and girls. It's failing. there's really no other way to describe this, right? Like, you're being paid in paper tokens that don't mean anything by an institution. In the bank's case, it's basically the same thing. An institution that can print these things as much as they want, thanks to the fractional reserve being a thing of the past. It's, you know, gone the way of the dodo. These guys are just making it up. You talk about cookbooks on the employment side and the inflation side. How about cooking the books on the currency value? You know, you're getting paid, especially if you're in Canadian banks, in the Canadian dollar. Why? Everyone intuitively knows the dollar is garbage. No one keeps any fucking money in their bank account. No one. That's how we get these surveys every week. People live in paycheck to paycheck. That's because even rich people, or I should say rich and poor alike, know that having cash in the bank doesn't do anything for them. Doesn't do anything for them. Rather buy a stock, an iPhone, a video game, a house, a car, whatever, a watch, piece of art, a Madex, I don't know. Everyone gets this. The question is, do they understand that there's an option? And I said this earlier, I'll say it again. If you don't understand there's an option, things look bleak. But if you understand there's an option, not only do you have something like Bitcoin, you got a community around you who help you make sense of the stuff that's going on in a way that your fucking bank teller cannot do and is paid not to do in many cases. I don't know how does this sustain? Are we going to go another 5 years?
Mutual funds that they offer. That's
the way
to go.
Mutual funds are the best thing. I don't know when. I remember telling my dad this 4 or 5 years ago when I started, like, actually, it's probably a little longer than that, maybe 7 years ago, when I started doing my own investing. And he asked me what I was in. And I was in, like, some shitty weed stocks or whatever. But I told him also, I stripped down the mutuals that my investment broker gave me because we had a private broker. And he's like, what do you mean you stripped them down? I go, you can just look at what they're putting you in and then just buy the same indexes on Wealthsimple or on TD at that time. And he goes, you can? I'm like, yeah. And I explained to him, like, they're taking 2 and 10, man. Like, you know, as soon as you take money out, it's fees on fees on fees. And I, you know, it's just crazy that people still do this. You know, there was a time when I think a lot of boomers felt that, like, there was some security and safety in using a quote unquote professional to do this. But now there's really no excuse. These guys, so not only, again, like, not only are you losing money in real terms, even if you're getting it back in nominal terms, but also some rent-seeking loser who has a certification and an MBA is taking money from you to literally sit on their hands and tell you that when things are good, it was their strategy, and that when things are bad, it was market conditions. Get fucked. Those days are over. It's Bitcoin or it's bust, man. That's where we're going now.
Well, something else going bust is consumer credit cards. And credit card debt, it's been rising in the past year, and we talked about that recently topped the $1 trillion mark for all American credit cards. And this is the first time in history that it's ever reached that level. And according to the Federal Reserve, the credit card rates currently stand at 22.8% at the end of August. 22.8% on $1 trillion. This is up from 16.3% a year earlier.
Is that a lot?
Or that
seems like a lot. Seems like a lot, Len. Is that a lot?
It is. It's fucking, and it gets worse because they're probably going to raise rates again and again. And that number is going to go to 25%, that the average rate. So they got more debt. They got higher carrying cost. And they're saying this represents $40 billion that needs to be paid over the next year on the interest payments. $40 billion people are going to spend just on interest payments alone. It's not going to go for buying new shoes. It's not going to buy for healthcare or anything like that. Just simply paying interest on their credit cards. And this is not only bad for the people holding the credit cards, it's troubling for retailers as well. I'll explain why. Credit card spending is down 11% month over month. Credit is drying up. People do not have the ability to buy stuff they used to because they don't have the ability to borrow anymore. Their credit cards are maxed or near maxed, or in their minds it's maxed because they don't want to add anything more to it because they're going to have to pay even more in interest. This is going to have a huge impact come this holiday season. We talked about it in the past. I mentioned we have Amazon Prime coming up, the Prime Days. Tomorrow, I think it starts. Prime Day, then we have Cyber Monday, Black Friday, or Black Friday first, then Cyber Monday, then Christmas. So all this shit, there's going to be, I suspect, these companies, they're going to be, the retailers, they're going to be reporting it's going to be a bad year. They're going to be bleeding money this year because people don't have the money to spend on goods anymore. So thoughts on that, Joey?
I thought the credit card spending was down because all the American fats are taking Ozempic now and not shopping at Walmart for bonbons. That's what I saw on Twitter the other day. That's not true. Do you have that in the story somewhere?
No, they're Dollarama or some other dollar store.
Even Dollar General.
Dollar, yeah, whatever the fuck it is. So
nice.
Yeah.
So I was at the Skins game in Washington last week, and I will tell you that I'm gonna judge a few books by their cover here. So forgive me if this is not your speed, but I'm gonna go ahead and do it anyway. That was an expensive evening and an expensive, you know, 2 days away between the hotel, the game. I bought a jersey. I bought a hat. You know, I went all in. That's my first time at watching the Skins in Washington. I really enjoyed it. And I would do it again, honestly, because I have the financial sort of ability to do it and not worry about how I'm going to put food on the table. But Len, I got to tell you, there was a lot of fucking people there, a bunch of them with whom I tailgated, and some tailgated near us, and I met at the game, met at the store, met at the beer stand, whatever. There's just no way that these guys had the financial, you know, sort of underpinning to manage a $300 US night at a game, you know, without the beers, without any merch, without parking, all that stuff. They're still spending money like drunken sailors over there. And I don't imagine that. I mean, Powell doesn't really talk about this when he does his, you know, little campfire speeches on whether or not he looks at certain data. He doesn't really talk about credit card spending and credit card interest rates, but maybe he should start if this is really the case. I'm constantly told that the U.S. consumer is, you know, weakening, but I got to tell you, it doesn't seem like they think that. And it doesn't seem to me, anecdotally, one 3-day trip in Washington doesn't seem to me like they are either. They're still spending all kinds of money on stuff that they just don't need. And in my estimation, probably can't afford. But it just doesn't matter. Like, once the beers are flowing, the people are chanting the Redskins tweet the cheer or whatever, like, it all goes out the window for these people. And I think a lot of people just spend impulsively like that in many different facets of their life. I have a hard time imagining that the same guy who's at the game, you know, drinking 10 beers, buying a brand new jersey, then suddenly goes home and exercises discretion when he decides whether or not to bet on Sunday's games, for example, or buy a pizza or two during Sunday's games instead of cooking at home, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's just, it doesn't seem likely to me. And so I think, again, there's either something missing in the data, or the data's not all there, or they want me to think something that's not actually true to justify an outcome, right? And kind of cook the means on me. But to me, man,
why did you buy your tickets for the Redskins?
I bought them, I don't know, 2 months ago, something like that. Yeah.
And I would imagine the same applies to everybody else you went to see over there. They didn't buy them last week.
But
everything that passes, it gets harder and harder to do.
It does get harder and harder. But I mean, for some of these guys, like season tickets, Len, like I'm talking to a couple season ticket holders, there's just no way. And I don't want to like speak ill of the guys I tailgated with, but I can't imagine that those guys are making a boatload of money. You know, they're, And maybe they are, but there's no way everyone in that stadium was. And the beers are the same price for everybody. And the jerseys are the same price for everybody. And the parking's the same price for everybody. And so, you know, again, like, is it a good financial decision after buying the tickets 2 months ago to just throw good money after bad? I don't know. Is it a better decision to sell the tickets? Is it, the point is that there's some discretionary spending that just will not go away. That's one example of it, but I think there are many others that are sort of under-discussed when it comes to the, you know, strength or weakness of the average consumer base.
We'll just have to see the stats come January to see how things play out for Prime Day, Black Friday.
Well, we'll get the stats in January, but we'll have to actually wait until like April for the real stats, right?
And by then, it's going to be fake as well, and because knee-deep in election. But let's talk about prices in Canada, because we could talk about Cloud World North. And Canada, well, they're going after the grocery stores. And our Prime Minister Trudeau tweeted out that Canada's largest grocers have committed to actions like increasing discounts, pricing freezes, and matching prices. He says it's just the first step, and he'll make sure to follow through, and he'll keep working to make life more affordable for people. But I'm wrong on this. I could be wrong on this. I'd like to be told if I am. I thought price matching already existed right now. I didn't think this was something that...
It's every major chain has this. Yeah.
So like, it's not like this is something that's new. So it's always already in existence. And then really just pointing out there's the reality that you could actually do this. But the government says they're going to be creating what they call a grocery task force. And this is going to be within the Office of Consumer Affairs. And it's going to be focused on monthly monitoring of grocers' commitments. And this comes at a time where a new survey shows that almost half of Canadians are prioritizing the cost of groceries instead of nutrition. 45% of people surveyed are placing a greater emphasis on the cost of the goods, cost of the groceries, rather than a nutritional value when it comes to the food they buy. They are picking the less healthy option. The long-term effects of this is people's health will suffer. This is going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money, because the healthcare system is publicly funded. It's going to make people less able to do the work because if they're sick more often, they're less productive. Ultimately, this is just not the right way to go. So people, obviously, they don't have the ability to buy the more nutritional food, but buying the crappy food over a longer period of time is going to have some real impacts negatively on that person and as in a greater society as a whole. But in terms of the price freezing and stuff like that, we talked about this in a previous episode. I think it was last week. This is something that obviously is, we're not in favor of in terms of what you're trying to achieve. Like the price freezing, lowering prices is great, but price freezing, I don't know, man. I think this is something that's going to just lead to grocers less likely to go out and perform the craft and start selling goods. If you're selling stuff at par or even at a loss, which could potentially happen if you start freezing prices, what's the point of selling anything? You just close shop and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And if there's less selection, less stores, less stuff on the shelves, you're not eating as much. And then it gets really problematic. So this is a problem really to do with too much money that's in circulation. And I think the number is 30% of all Canadian dollars in circulation was, I don't know if it created, but it basically was added to the system in the past 2.5-3 years. And as a result, when you have more money chasing the same goods, well, you're going to need more money to chase those goods as a result. And here we are. Everything is, I can't believe it took this long for shit like this to rise in prices. I thought it would have been more immediate impact, but I guess things just take its time to work through the system. And it's going to get worse moving forward. I don't think this is something that's just going to stop overnight. Even with this new measures of price freezing and increasing discounts, I think it's going to be a lot of problem moving forward for people putting food on their plates and feeding their families. It's going to be too much for some people to bear. And already you see people out homeless and shit like that. It's only going to get worse.
How does a task force help solve the problem, which ultimately is, you know, I think two-pronged? One is we have too many taxes and levies that affect the price of goods in Canada. And the second is that we have an oligopoly in the grocery industry. Is the task force going to do anything about either of those two things? I mean, if not, then what are we doing? That's the end of the story. We Canada has some of the highest monthly costs in grocery, in mobile internet and television, and you know, probably a few other industries that I can't name off the top of my head, because we just refuse to allow competition. And we talked, I think, a little bit before, not at the same time when we started doing these stories, but there was a story in the National Post around the time the inflation started to creep into services, like cellular, I think was the example in the story, about how Canada is a country of oligopolies and the consumer loves it. And like, the spin is there. There's clearly some lobbying going on, as you would expect, for people to defend that hill that they've, you know, created for themselves. A very nice hill, by the way, if you're one of these oligopoly, you know, participants. But, you know, the only time these guys are ever on the same team is when they're trying to prevent someone new from coming into the market, whether it's cell phone, grocery, or otherwise. And until we break those things up, it's just not going to matter. Everything is just bullshit until those two things change. If they don't change, then expect to pay higher prices. Period. End of story. That's all there is to it.
I got a recipe for failure
for
you. Canada's fertility rate reached a record low of 1.33 children per woman. I guess, is that the correct way to say it these days?
Gotta be. Anyway, gotta be.
Anyways, this is compared to 1.44 in 2021. And 90% of the population growth in Canada in the last 12 months has been through immigration. Digest that. That's interesting stats. And, yeah.
What can nothing you say about that, really? Well, people...
Yeah, nothing.
I mean, people say that, like, again, they say it's like the syringe juice from a couple of years ago causing this. But pretty clearly, I think if you're a Bitcoiner, you have to admit that the more likely cause is just that people have no money for kids, no time to have sex, and maybe also the social skills are lacking in terms of finding a partner. Like, how else would you describe the current situation? We talked about this before, how kids are like, you know... I can't remember where we talked about it. Maybe I was bullshitting with my friends about how kids now are choosing not to drink, and the newspapers all saying, oh, it's this healthy avenue that young people have chosen, maybe for the first time, you know, and if you look backwards 20, 30, 40 years, everyone goes, you know, drinking at bars and stuff like that when they're kind of coming of age. It's social lubricant. That's what it's for a lot of people. And everyone's saying, well, kids now, they don't do it. They stay home and they go out without drinking. My argument would be that kids are afraid to go to the bar because they don't have social skills. And this, I think, really speaks to that point. As the years go by, more and more kids, I say kids, young people, don't want to have kids, can't find partners. And we've talked about this before, the number of men over 30 who are not having sex regularly, like every 6 months or something, which is not regular, by the way, it's extremely low. And it's crazy that more people are not worried about this kind of complete fall off and what it takes to propagate a species. Like, forget about, you know, data and immigration stats and all this other kind of, you know, modern stuff. To propagate a species, we have to have sex with each other. That's what we got to do. And it doesn't seem like we're doing it at all. And so I would suggest to people that there will come a time, whether soon or in the distant future, that these quote unquote immigrants we're bringing in are going to find themselves in the same boat. They're going to have the same problems. I can't have a kid because I don't have any social skills. And I don't have time. I can't afford it, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, big problem here, man. Big problems brewing. I've talked about this before. I talked about it with like SB on Woke Antidote and TB on Woke Antidote, that there's no precedent for this. You got a generation of kids who are going to have to front the bill for the largest government, you know, spending orgy of all time. They're all addicted to SSRIs. Every single one of them is on some kind of upper or downer. None of them think they have to be responsible in school. None of them can find partners, and none of them want jobs. Good luck. If you think the currency gonna help you with that, guys, I don't know. I would want to have my money in something outside that system. That's for damn sure.
I wonder how many people, like women per se, are not wanting to have kids because of a couple of reasons. Number one, they're more career oriented.
Probably
or
not.
Two, they just can't afford it. They Probably realize not. Having a kid. So it's not just a social aspect. It's just there is the reality check. It's, well, I'm talking about the economics. If they're more interested in their career, all the more power to them. So that is going to obviously take into, it's going to make a dent into how many kids are going to be born per woman as a result.
Sure. Of course.
Yeah. Interesting story here. The climate justice ship. Not sure if this is truly climate.
I did see this.
It's owned by a Monaco-based firm. This is a cargo ship named Climate Justice, and it's transporting shit between Canada and Asia. It was found that this past week, it was docked in Vancouver, and it was carrying between, this is the Climate Justice ship, by the way, carrying between 30,000 and 40,000 tons of coal that was loaded up in Vancouver. And it's Climate Justice in name only. So they were interested. It's interesting because this name that they was given to Climate Justice, it's reported because it's a cleaner burning ship compared to its fellow bulk carriers. So the ship is eventually going to be going over to Korea to offload over there, and so they can start burning the coal in their factories over there. But yeah, anyways, one thing I learned through all this, Port of Vancouver ranks as the largest single port for coal, largest single coal port in North America. I had no idea that so much coal in North America goes strictly through Vancouver. I thought BC is a very green.
Isn't that also, I think Mike Campbell and I talked about this. It's like the least efficient port on the continent, I'm pretty sure, Vancouver. Or it's like one of the worst of the 500 that they survey every year. Boomer can maybe tell me. He's in the chat. I'm pretty sure we talked about this before. Not this story, but like on top of it, bringing in coal, they don't do so very effectively. I would venture to guess. It's great. You'll love to see it.
Well, I'm wondering, I mean, compared, I guess, to the LA ports, which has strikes quite frequently, I guess, yeah, Vancouver is, but whatever. It's just funny that Climate Justice is loaded up with coal. And, well, let's talk about wait times in ERs and emergency rules. And in fact, it's killing people in some sad stories. And one came out this past week, a 67-year-old woman from Nova Scotia. She was waiting at an ER in her province of Nova Scotia, waited for 7 hours, didn't get seen by anybody, got fed up and left. An hour later, dead.
Insane.
Incredible. And in fact, the number of Canadians who visit emergency departments across the country, and the ones that only go there for obviously emergency reasons, they leave and give up. This number has been going up. It's fivefold increase, in fact. So people go to the emergency room, they don't get seen, they leave because they're fed up. That number's gone up fivefold. So this group is even this so big, in fact, they're being coded by hospitals and emergency departments as LWBS, patients who leave without being seen. And the Canadian Institute for Health Information, the CIHI, shows that back in 2003, 2004, so 20 years ago, 184,000 people came to hospitals and left without medical attentions. They had enough. But in 2022, that number jumped to 963,000 patients without receiving care. 963,000 people went to an emergency room, waited too long, had enough, and just fucking left. In this case, this lady died as a result of that. I'm not sure if she could have lived if she got medical attention right away, but this number is going to get worse moving forward. We have more and more people coming into Canada, and I don't think they're putting the amount of money into resources like healthcare to match the amount of people coming in. So more people coming in, more people using the existing healthcare and other services, no more money being poured in. I guess there is some money, but it's not to the same degree as people coming in. The amount of people waiting is going to get even worse and worse, and more people are going to get fed up. 7 hour, 8 hour, 20 hour waits, it's just going to be the norm these days.
It is crazy, especially in like these population centers, right? There was a story from, I think, Brampton, where Brampton hospitals were telling people, don't come here. If you got a problem, you got to go somewhere else. We can't see you. So you're paying taxes at one of the highest rates in the country, and you can't go to a hospital. You can't get into a school. You can't get a family doctor. You're paying more for groceries than anywhere else. Your mortgage is through the roof. You got to live with 30 other people, Amazon at night, Uber during the night, Amazon during the day. Welcome to Canada. The dream, right? Completely untenable for a new resident. I feel for these people, man. And, you know, knock on wood, I've not had any, you know, serious medical problems over the last, you know, basically my entire life. Nothing was ever, you know, a life-threatening injury, but I really feel bad for these people. I truly do, who are having to go to these ERs, leaving, in some cases dying. I think, again, not to, you know, pump up Mike Campbell too much. So I do love his podcast. He's a great friend of the show. He was saying, I think on Twitter the other day, that something like 20,000 Canadians died last year waiting for surgeries and tests. So not even like, you know, something's wrong and you're just waiting for the surgery and die. That's bad enough. How about you die waiting to find out what's wrong with you? Like that's, it's not first world stuff. And there's a reason why Canadians go to Cuba, the States, wherever, basically anywhere else. All from all those countries, by the way, which we take, are allegedly taking skilled labor, including doctors and nurses who can't get qualified here for whatever reason, all sorts of nonsense, red tape, blah, blah, blah. Someone's lying in their pockets and rent seeking in that process somewhere, I'm sure, but I haven't dug into that, but it's always the case. People go overseas and to other countries, cross borders, to get that same treatment. And by the way, sometimes it's pretty cheap, Len. And it's sad to see, man, as a Canadian. I don't want to leave, but damn, I also, again, it's difficult for me to imagine a situation where I would put up with any of this now that I'm kind of, you know, I hate using the term like awake, but I've learned so much over the last few years that I just wouldn't stand for that if I was in an ER. It's not going to be a 12-hour wait for me. I'll cause a scene, man. Yeah, I have no choice. I've been paying taxes for 36 years, my parents before me and their parents before them. I expect to get some of the services that I've paid for. And not to rag on new Canadians, they don't deserve it, to get this kind of criticism. But there has to be a line somewhere in the sand about how much you paid in and what you can expect to get back. And whether that's getting service in your own area code or showing up 6 months ago and needing help. I don't know where the line is, but soon, like I've said before, as the economic conditions in the country worsen and as the services in the country worsen, as the competency level worsens, fault lines that you could easily paper over before will start to resurface. And this is going to be one of them. I expect it, and we're starting to see it already by the sounds of things.
Here's something else that services are not being rendered. This past week, it was reported that there were no more ambulances available in Toronto. So there's a point this past week that if you called for an ambulance, there was none available to respond to your call. Toronto had no units available, none at this. And in fact, in one instance, an 80-year-old woman fell, fractured her arm, and she had to lay on the ground for hours and hours waiting for a unit to show up to take
her to the hospital.
And apparently this isn't abnormal. Ambulance shortages across the province are not uncommon. I've never heard this before.
But you never needed an ambulance, right? And not got one.
Clearly, I haven't. Yeah. So, yeah, you're paying for something. And then when you call in an emergency, you need, you know, somebody to come in to pick you up because you're hurt, you're fucked up. There's no ambulance there to do it. Like, man, is that not the end of this whole game here? Like, really, like, this is closer to the end than anything else.
It seems that way. And I won't dig deep on this because we're like long on time here, but it's true that there's signposts along the way to like a, you know, to the end of a empire, and I think you're looking at some of them, right? You call an ambulance for your elderly grandmother. She can't get one. She got to lie on the floor with a broken arm for 3 hours. What are the ambulances doing? Why don't we have more? What's the cost of the ambulances? You know, what are we paying the drivers? What have we done, again, to match the level of services needed to run the kind of country that we, you know, the royal we want to run? The answer, much like housing, is that we didn't do enough. And clearly, those chickens are coming home to roost now.
I think it's because when they pick people up, they have to go to ER, and then if they wait there before they get seen. So if the ER is backlogged, then it creates a backlog with the ambulance. It's just says,
I don't know. I don't know. I've never been to the ER in an ambulance, so I'm not sure how that works. Presumably, if you call an ambulance, like, it's not just a triage and they drop you off an ER. Like, you must get seen, right? Because I don't think ambulances are free here, are they? I'm pretty sure they're not.
I think you have to pay every time, like, the fire comes out, every time an ambulance comes out, I think you pay out of pocket for that. Like, a small fee.
So it's not free. So if you call an ambulance, like, you're kind of getting over one hurdle there, and assumedly you would have an injury that, you know, is threatening enough. I don't know. Again, knock on wood, I hope I never have to make that decision. But it's not uncommon this is happening. You're right. You see this more and more. We saw it during COVID, right? COVID, everyone was talking about how hospitals are overpopulated. We got a lockdown. Hospitals are always over capacity, guys. Always. It's always the case. They're always at 105%. It's been like this for decades. Not new. That was another thing that drove me nuts during COVID. But anyway, story for another time.
Well, Canadian job numbers, they're in. This is the last story we'll talk about on the Canadian side. 63,800 jobs added to our job count. And the number of employees in the public sector increased by 37,000. Think about this. Over 1 million people, they're saying, are employed today compared to before the pandemic. So over 1 million employed more now than before the pandemic. But by my numbers here, Canada admitted 2, maybe 3 million people since before the pandemic. So If 1 million more people are working now, that is 1 to 2 million people who are either too young, too old, or unwilling to work.
Yep.
And breaking this down further, 11.3% of the unemployment rate are Canadians aged 15 to 24. This is double that than the country overall. So the young people are more than ever taking the burden of the unemployment. Not only that, they're less likely nowadays than in the past to be entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurship is going down in this group of people. So the group of young people who want to be their own boss, the percentage of that has fallen over the past 25 years. And the people that are entrepreneurs, I don't want to generalize here, but generally I would say they're a class of people that are driven, they're focused, they want to achieve something on their own. And plus, they're able to contribute to society where they could potentially hire people. And if you have less people that want to be in that class, I don't think this is a recipe for success. It's a recipe for ultimately failure. So I look at all these numbers and there's nothing here I see that's really good. And I'll leave it at that.
I'm looking here, I can't find it, but I think we talked about like 2 weeks ago, maybe last week, the Sobeys price margins, right? They were being targeted in some government communications. And to your point about entrepreneurship, you know, if you're targeted at 3% margins, what is the point of starting a business in Canada? Again, difficult to become an entrepreneur in this country because there's so much red tape, so many taxes, so many hurdles. Why not just pick up and go to the States and do it there? I mean, you see that over and over again. Canadians going abroad to start businesses, go to school, make contacts, start their working life, et cetera, et cetera. Our best and brightest here are leaving the provinces at staggering rates. I saw a great article the other day. I wish I'd saved it for my notes. But basically, the Canadians under 25 are leaving all provinces for other countries at rates never before seen. Can you imagine that? How do you remedy that? You know, how much immigration do you need for that? How many tax breaks do you need for that? It's not palatable for anyone to start a business here. And it seems to me like it's less and less about, you know, it's less and less about the political stripe you wear and more about the kind of environment that's now, I think, become entrenched, right? The sort of attitude towards successful people. Like I said earlier, you know, displaying strength makes you a target, even though when the chips are down, whether or not you can display strength, whether you can display strength in a way that is, you know, threatening is the wrong word, but you get the idea. If you can't do it, then it doesn't really do you any good. The rest of it's just, you know, sort of made up nonsense. And people who can display strength and put themselves out there and do good things are choosing to do it elsewhere, clearly.
Yeah, it's definitely fluff. And Joey, with that, that's the end of our Clown World segment. So for people listening in, thank you for tuning in. And I'm not sure when you're going to be releasing this, before or after the Bitcoin show.
We'll decide after. I don't know. Keep it steady. Bitcoin on Tuesdays and then Clown World on Wednesdays.
Wow, sounds like a plan. Yeah.
If you're on audio, take care of yourself. See it in 1 minute otherwise for the rest of the story.
Yeah, take care, PV. Don't be a cuck.